This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, the weekend edition of Family Research Council's Washington Watch.
Hello and welcome to the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm your host, David Salkeld, a constitutional conservative, husband, and homeschool dad. Well, on Monday of this week, well before the riots in North Carolina that have been dominating the news, Tony had a chance to talk with the governor of North Carolina, Pat McCrory. The governor has proposed a compromise on the controversial HB 2 bill, which mandates that state restrooms be gender-specific, but makes no imposition on the private sector. The compromise is contingent on the city of Charlotte repealing their bathroom ordinance. The city, however, seems unwilling to budge. Here now is that conversation between Governor McCrory and FRC's Tony Perkins.
What you put on the table over the weekend, or what the leadership there in North Carolina put on the table, was, as I understand it, an offer to the city council of Charlotte and those who have been misconstruing HB 2, simply saying, look, we'll go back to what was status quo prior to the city of Charlotte imposing this bathroom ordinance on private entities. And, you know, we'll repeal HB 2 if you do away with the ordinance. Is that, in essence, what you offered over the weekend?
Absolutely. And it's more than a bathroom ordinance. It's really redefining gender for our city of Charlotte, where I was mayor of 14 years, for the state of North Carolina, and for the entire nation. And that's really what this whole debate is about, Tony, is what is the definition of gender? Is it a gender based upon your biology or your anatomy? Or is gender now going to be based upon what President Obama wants, and that's your how you think you are, or how you like to express yourself? And that's really the debate, and the national media doesn't seem to get it. But it is, that impacts in our bathrooms, locker rooms, showers, and our schools, and our locker rooms, and our universities, and in our businesses.
Right.
And everyone is focusing, a very, very powerful group, Tony, that you know about, called the HRC. I've said they're more powerful than the NRA. And they're showing their power because they just stopped the city of Charlotte from making a very reasonable compromise solution. And they are that powerful, and they put a lot of pressure on corporations and the NCAA and the ACC and the NBA to capitulate to their definition of gender in the United States of America. And now the Obama administration has done the same thing. And it's a sad commentary that North Carolina is the target of the HRC group, and gives the impression that this is just a North Carolina battle when it's a United States battle.
Governor McCrory, one thing I would have to point out that I think is most onerous about what the city of Charlotte has done, and what is completely misreported or not reported at all by the media, is the fact that this was imposed upon private entities. It wasn't just that the city wanted to do it on their property. They wanted to force private entities to abide by and adhere to their twisted view of gender.
Yeah, in fact, the national media has portrayed this as a conservative bathroom bill, when it was, in fact, the left-wing liberals who wrote the bathroom bill in the city of Charlotte. It was a mandate for all private sector businesses, if they have public restrooms or locker rooms or showers, that they would have to entertain the concept of gender identity or gender expression for people to come into those establishments or those restrooms. And if they didn't abide by that City of Charlotte regulation, the businesses would be fined. And the liberal media never talks about this. They keep talking about North Carolina's bathroom bill. It wasn't. The North Carolina government overturned the city of Charlotte's bathroom bill. The only thing we did was say, however, in our schools, in our universities, in our rest stops, in our parks, we're going to recognize gender as the way we've defined it, and that's based upon your identity.
But private entities,
on your anatomy.
Private entities could do whatever they wanted under HB 2.
Absolutely.
Right?
North Carolina, according to the law, HB 2, which is the new term that the liberals use, it's the name, it's not even the name of the bill, but it's been seen as a discriminatory bill. The bill actually says private sector, you can have unisex, you can have joint, you can do anything you want. That's not my business. But in my schools, in our universities, and I'm talking about elementary schools, too,
right,
and our universities, I put out an order that we would not do that. We would, if someone has a unique circumstance with their gender, we would make reasonable accommodations, as opposed to everyone else having to make accommodations for the very small percentage of people that has this problem.
Well, and you are elected. You are elected as well as the legislature in North Carolina to oversee those public facilities. So that is your responsibility to do.
Absolutely. Just like it's if you run a major bank, it's your responsibility to determine what your policy should be. And that's exactly what I'm telling. But you wouldn't know that from the national media based upon what we're doing. And now I've got the NCAA getting involved in this and actually boycotting the state of North Carolina, except for tournaments being played on our college campuses. And they've literally said, if you play on a college campus, it's safe. But if you play five blocks away in a city arena, it's unsafe. It's Tony, it's very Orwellian. It's almost the book 1984, where the thought police are determining what the rules of the game are, including sports and entertainment industry, of very multi-billion dollar nonprofit tax-exempt organizations.
Well, it is Orwellian because they redefine terms, as we're seeing very clearly with the issue of gender. You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. My guest, Governor Pat McCrory of North Carolina. All right, Governor, so this reasonable proposal put on the table where things could go back to status quo. HB2 would not be an issue if the ordinance there in Charlotte was rescinded. The mayor there says, no, won't do it. What does that tell you?
I think it tells me that this is now a national issue and national pressure coming on North Carolina. And North Carolina is the punching bag for, sadly, a lot of corporations and the corporate elite and the sports and entertainment elite, the liberal elite. And I'm calling them out. And as you know, I appreciate your help, but I feel kind of by myself because everyone's intimidated by this Orwellian purging of anyone who disagrees with these people, believe in discrimination. And I'm the least discriminatory person, as most people are, and I don't believe in discrimination.
Right.
But I do believe in common sense gender definitions for our country as we've been using. And what this is going to do, Tony, and I've got to run into a meeting real quick, but what this is going to do is it's all going to go to the Supreme Court, and that's what makes this presidential election so important.
One final question. I know you got to go, Governor, but this doesn't stop with North Carolina, does it? This has the potential to spread all across this country.
No, this is a national. This is. I cannot stress more. This is not a North Carolina issue. This is a national issue, and 21 other states have joined in a lawsuit against the Obama administration, Justice Department, who have put out an edict for all private sector corporations with over 15 individuals. They have to recognize gender identity. Regarding restroom and locker room and changing facilities. And also all our universities, Title IX, will have to recognize that if they have Title IX funding. The federal government has that on hold right now, and that's why this will be going to the Supreme Court most likely in the next 4 or 5 months, and that's why these upcoming elections are extremely important.
They certainly are. Governor Pat McCrory, thanks so much for stopping by to talk with us today.
Tony, thank you very much. God bless.
You can find out more about Governor McCrory along with HB2 when you visit TonyPerkins.com. When we return, we'll be joined by Peter Kurzenow from the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. Don't go away. We'll be right back with more of the weekend edition of Washington Watch right after this. Every day, Christian values are being pushed out of the public square and out of public policy at an alarming rate. What can ordinary Christian citizens do to make their voices heard in an arena that is set on silencing them? Send us a question you may have about how you can better live out your faith beyond the four walls of your church. Go to frc.org/contact and enter Question of the Week in the subject line for the chance to be published on our blog. Thank you for standing with us. Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm your host, David Salkeld. Well, one recent report from the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights is making news for all the wrong reasons. The Commission's report, released earlier this month, discussed issues like religious liberty, but not in the way that you might think. Commission Chairman Martin Castro was quoted as saying, The phrases religious liberty and religious freedom will stand for nothing except hypocrisy, so long as they remain code words for discrimination, intolerance, racism, sexism, homophobia, Islamophobia, Christian supremacy, or any form of intolerance, end quote. Astounding to hear our first freedom described in such deplorable terms. Commissioner Peter Kurzenau joined Tony on Tuesday to talk about the report.
Peter, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thanks for having me, Tony.
Peter, I'm just going to start with a couple questions. I read your rebuttal, and it was very... Actually, it was a kind of a history of religious liberty and freedom and really what we're faced with in terms of this collision. But I want to pull from some of the things you said. You said this conflict between religious liberty and non-discrimination principles is a profound conflict. Explain that.
Well, I had originally asked for this very hearing to be conducted several years ago because I saw that there was mounting tension. And there shouldn't be really, but there's always going to be some tension between principles of non-discrimination and religious liberty, especially when we've seen this trajectory toward, among other things, gay marriage. And in anticipation of that, this was, you know, years before the Obergefell decision, I knew that we were going to have to take a look at all of the issues pertaining to discrimination versus religious liberty. How can we reconcile the two? And that's why I came up with the title Peaceful Coexistence. That hearing was conducted, or the impetus for it, was when the commission, which is an 8-member commission, was evenly divided 4-4 between conservatives and liberals. But it was heard when the commission membership changed because of the Obama administration to 6 liberals and 2 conservatives, and that's why you have the kind of report that you have, along with, of course.
And by the way, just for the benefit, of our listeners, this is supposed to be a nonpartisan or bipartisan commission where no more than they cannot have more than 3 of one particular party. What's the number?
Yeah, you cannot have a majority of one particular party. You know, it can't be more than 4. But what happens is very often people will identify themselves as independents.
Correct.
And you'll end up with, nominally 4 Democrats, but you'll have 6 liberals on the commission. That's what we currently have.
You have there's one Republican on the commission.
One Republican, that's me, and one independent, Gail Harriet, who's also a conservative.
Right. So it's if you look at it from party affiliation, it's very deceptive, but it clearly is not, as you talk ideologically, it tilts very strongly to the left.
Right. What the concern that Gail and I have, and I think most liberty-loving Americans should have, and most people of faith will have, is the commission's report is really a bellwether. It tells you the direction in which the left goes and how they perceive religion. I don't mean to take a broad brush and smear all folks on the left or all liberals, but remember there's a reason why the mention of God or Jesus Christ was booed at the Democratic Convention back in 2012. There's an advancing, and I don't mean to say this about all Democrats, that's a particularly condensed or specific strata of liberals who are at the convention, but nonetheless, it is clear that there's an advancing agenda on much of the left that is hostile to religion, views religion as an excuse to discriminate against individuals, mainly on the basis of sexual orientation, but perhaps for other reasons, too. That is clear throughout the commission's report and the statements of some of my fellow commissioners. And as a result, what we are starting to see, along with the repercussions of the Obergefell decision and statutes that are being enacted throughout the country, ordinances, edicts coming from the Office of Civil Rights of the Department of Education, is a subordination of religion to principles of quote-unquote non-discrimination.
Well, you talk about that, Peter, in your rebuttal. You say, and you do a great job, I think, of explaining these two conflicting worldviews and what's behind them, but you say it requires the left's worldview, this secular worldview, it requires purging the public square of religious symbols, denying the validity of public policy with religious origins, and ending longstanding public religious practices. Is that what we see unfolding?
I think we are, and you see it almost every day. There's something, someplace in the country where the left's worldview is being imposed, and it's happening rapidly. You know, the religious practices that we've taken for granted over centuries and for most of this country's existence are now being stigmatized. Give you one, just one example. In Tennessee, in order to give some space to individuals who are counselors, psychological counselors, psychiatrists, substance abuse counselors, who are traditional religious observers who may not, for example, want to counsel someone that a same-sex practice was permissible, it may have been against the counselor's religion, there was an exemption provided for those individuals, an exemption that would simply say that if a patient sought counseling that the counselor, for religious reasons, couldn't provide or would prefer not to provide, as long as that counselor could make a referral to that patient of someone who would willingly provide those services, that counselor would not be required to provide that type of counseling that would be contrary to his religious beliefs. Well, the left went crazy about that.
Right.
That was not an adequate accommodation. They wanted to mandate that the counselor, regardless of his religious belief and regardless of the type of counseling that was being sought, provide such counseling. And whenever we see an attempt to have such an accommodation, to have a peaceful coexistence, the left or the secularists who are constantly preaching to us, no pun intended, about tolerance, all of a sudden become some of the most intolerant people you want. It's their way or the highway.
And the media doesn't always report it, so people don't see it. They don't realize how prevalent it is because the media doesn't cover it as much as they do the other side of the issue. You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. Peter Kirsenow, my guest, he is a commissioner of the United States Commission on Civil Rights, dissenting or taking issue with the findings. And I understand, Peter, you wanted to get this report out there so the public could see what is happening to religious liberty. And we're out of time in this, but I so appreciate you coming on because, I think your rebuttal to the majority was very thoughtful and a well-documented response. And one of the things that you pointed out repeatedly was that the free exercise of religion is a constitutionally enumerated right where the sexual rights are statutory in their creation, other than when you, if you were to point to discrimination laws under the 14th Amendment protections. But Peter, I want to thank you for joining us. Thanks so much, and we're going to have you back on to talk more about this.
Thanks, Tony. I appreciate it.
To find out more about the Commission on Civil Rights report, go to TonyPerkins.com. Coming up next, a look at presidential polling with frequent guest Scott Rasmussen. We'll be right back with more Washington Watch right after this.
Some say the government should provide health care and college tuition to citizens at no cost. The idea of offering such services for free is understandably attractive to many, and that is why it is vital that we understand socialism's foundational philosophies so we can combat this fatally flawed government solution to a human problem. Watch former Congressman Bob McEwen lead an informative discussion about socialism and its true consequences at frc.org/McEwen. That's frc.org/MCEWEN.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm your host, David Salkeld. You know, the current race for president has been an intriguing roller coaster ride like never before. Over 20 candidates from both major parties threw their hats into the ring. Well, the primary season is finally over, and America now has to essentially choose between GOP nominee Donald Trump and Democrat nominee Hillary Clinton. They have been sparring with each other through dueling rallies and speeches. But come this Monday night, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton will be debating each other one-on-one and face-to-face. To give us a preview of that debate and a look at recent polling, here is the president of STRC, Scott Rasmussen. He joined Tony on Thursday and had the following discussion.
Scott, welcome back to Washington Watch.
It's great to be with you tonight, and it's especially a fascinating time in this race with the polls close and that debate coming up.
Well, you mentioned the polls. I mean, they're basically, depending on which poll you look at, one will be ahead in one will be ahead in the other. They're essentially tied, are they not?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say the race is tied. You know, I've been doing a battleground state analysis on Fox, looking at different states each week. And what you find there is because the race is getting close, the Electoral College is getting close, Donald Trump has a real shot to pick up states like Ohio and Florida that eluded Mitt Romney. But all of this is where things stand today. And, of course, what really matters is where they stand on November 8th.
Well, are there any trends? Do you see any trends developing?
Well, the trends recently have all been in Donald Trump's direction, and most of them have to do with turnout. What we're seeing is something that people talked about but didn't know how accurate it would be. Hillary Clinton is failing to generate enthusiasm among younger voters and minorities. So turnout among the Obama coalition appears to be down right now. Donald Trump is generating enthusiasm among white working-class voters, and that is helping him, especially in states like Ohio. You know, when you look at all of this, the thing that I keep telling people, this year is a little bit different. We go through the motions of talking about these polls and analysis and Electoral College like it's a normal year. But we have two candidates who are viewed unfavorably by a majority of the American people. And what nobody really likes to talk about is because each team has about 40 or 42% of the electorate backing them right now, the remaining people, those who will make the decision, that 15 or 18%, they are generally people who do not like either candidate. So people who loathe the two choices are going to decide the next president.
The numbers I've seen, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I've looked at some polling of unaffiliated voters who would fall into that category, are breaking for Donald Trump in the last numbers I saw. Is that correct?
That's correct. And that's not something that should be all that surprising. The question is going to be the margin. But the next thing, when you look at all that polling data, and again, I go back to this idea that the people who could change their mind, who aren't committed, who are maybe saying they're voting for Gary Johnson right now or Jill Stein, what's interesting about them is they don't have an attachment to the candidates. They don't have a strong feeling. You know, 4 years ago, if you talked to a Barack Obama supporter, nothing you could do would change their mind. But because of this weak attachment, because of this large group who don't like either candidate, events like the debate next week, events like what's happening in Charlotte today, events like the terror attacks last week, and the way that the candidates respond to them could lead to a very big difference. I'm right now the race is close, but it would not surprise me if either candidate coming out of the debate and events after that opened up a fairly significant lead.
Okay, Scott Rasmussen, my guest. We're talking about Monday night's presidential debate, first one where Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton will square off in the 2016 presidential cycle. All right, Scott, what has to happen for one of the two to come out with a significant bump in Monday night's debate?
Well, you know, it's funny to even be raising this question because for the last two decades when people have asked about debates, I have been downplaying their significance, pointing out that there's hardly ever a lasting change coming out of the debates. But this year, because of Donald Trump's unconventional approach to things, I would expect the debates will have a huge audience, a significant number of people who aren't committed, and you know, to either candidate. And you can identify things. You know, Donald Trump should make sure that he looks the part of a president, but gets his points across without being too aggressive, or Hillary Clinton needs to make it look like she's strong both physically and politically, and that she has a that she can somehow show competence without highlighting the fact that she's part of the status quo. But when you go through that analysis, I think you miss what happens in a debate. We have two candidates with a proven ability to say the wrong thing at the wrong time. The tone and attitudes that come through may matter more than specific things. You remember famously when Al Gore was shown sighing at some of George W. Bush's comments, and it really left a bad impression in a lot of people's mouths. So I don't know what the moment will be, but I would suspect there will be a couple of highlights that become the defining moment of this debate, and they could swing it significantly one way or the other. You know, you talk about these are volatile issues. What's happened? I lived in Charlotte for many years. It's breaking my heart what's going on in the city there right now. And there are no easy answers, but the way you address that question can have a significant impact on the way people perceive your worldview.
So it's safe to say that the stakes are very high Monday night for both candidates.
I don't think they have been higher for any debate in any time that I can remember. And, you know, when you're a campaign manager or you're part of that debate prep team, you're always nervous about what the candidates will say when they get out there on the stage. But most of the time, you've prepped them enough and the roles, you know, Barack Obama and Mitt Romney, it was a conventional enough setting. You felt pretty comfortable that things wouldn't get too out of hand. I think both campaigns are going to be extremely nervous when their candidates are on their stage. And I think it is quite possible that either candidate could get under the skin of the other and cause them to make some sort of a mistake.
We could have a cage match Monday night. It's going to be interesting.
Well, it's a shame we're talking about a presidential race that way, but that's absolutely true.
All right, Scott, thanks so much for joining us. As always, love talking to you.
Thank you. Look forward to doing it again.
To find out more about Scott Rasmussen or anything you've heard on today's program, also, while you're there, sign up for Tony's Washington Update. It's a daily email highlighting the important issues affecting your faith, family, and freedom. Well, that's it for this week's show. I'm David Salkeld, thanking you for being with us, and I encourage you to be back here next week for the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins.
The weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you've heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can help support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 866-372-7234.